is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I think the one piece that was the hardest was the leadership with this team. We had a lot of capable guys in different areas, but we didn't have one alpha dog. We didn't have one guy where it was just his team. So we had to kind of spread it around, and we really didn't find our way in that until really into January.
John Krikorian has been the men's basketball head coach at Christopher Newport University since June 14, 2010. He is just the fourth head coach in the program's 53-year history and has led the Captains to remarkable success, including its first three Final Four appearances and first Division III national championship in the 2022-2023 season. The Captains defeated Mount Union in the 2023 title game in Fort Wayne, Indiana, to capture the school's first title in 55 seasons of Christopher Newport University men's basketball. Krikorian's squads also advanced to the 2015-16 Final Four in Salem, Virginia, as well as the 2018-2019 Final Four in Fort Wayne. In his tenure, Krikorian has led the Captains to 9 NCAA tournaments in 12 seasons, including the last 7 tournaments in a row. CNU is the only school in the nation to win at least one game in each of the last 7 NCAA tournaments, and Krikorian now has a career mark in tournament games of 23-7. Hey, Hoopheads, transform your training this May with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get $3,000 off any commercial machine in the month of May. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Dominic Amorosa, head boys basketball coach at Strike Judge with College Prep in Houston, Texas, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. You'll want to have your notebook ready as you listen to this episode with John Krikorian from 2023 Division III national champions, Christopher Newport University in Newport News, Virginia. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are pleased to welcome back to the Hoopheads pod the Division III national championship coach for 2023, John Krikorian, head men's basketball coach at Christopher Newport University. John, welcome back, man.
Hey, Mike. Great to be here. Thanks for having me. Great.
Absolutely.
Hey, Mike, fantastic. Before we begin, John, I want to thank you, John. As a Baldwin Wallace alumni, you beat Mountain Union in the championship game, and I was very happy about that. And congratulations to you. But it brings me so much joy because we always hear about their football program. I didn't need to hear as a Baldwin Wallace alumni about their basketball program, too. So thank you, John. I just want to.
I am sure that we will get into. I'm sure we will get into that and that game and all their great history at Mountain Union. So I'm looking forward to it, but glad we could get that one for you.
Absolutely. Congratulations on the national championship. Obviously, thinking back to our first conversation, I know that we talked a lot about what it takes to be able to get your program to the level where you can compete year in and year out for a national championship, and to see it come to fruition, I'm sure was extremely gratifying. And what we're going to do tonight is kind of go through the chronicle of the entire season and just look at the different inflection points that led your team to what eventually became a national championship. So let's start by going back to the previous season and talk a little bit about how that season sort of laid the foundation and groundwork for what eventually became this national championship year.
Yeah, and so that's still relatively short span when you talk about 1 year. And so I'm assuming at some point we'll talk more about how our entire history led us to this season and that game. But the real, I think the journey for this particular season started with the loss at Marietta in the Elite Eight in 2022. We had as talented a team as I've ever coached, probably that CNU has ever seen. And we had a magical year in 21-22. Really felt like we had all the pieces, all the chemistry. You know, just we thought we had everything that you need to be national champions. But we lost to Marietta in the second game of the season. And that ended up costing us a bid to host in the second weekend. And so we had to go to Marietta. We had a really nice lead heading into the half. And they were able to come back and beat us, you know, really at the end. The game, you know, probably should have gone overtime. I mean, the thing was right down to the wire. And that thing was incredibly painful. It was a great environment. It was a high level basketball game. Our guys really felt like we were the better team. And that night, certainly Marietta was, and not to take anything away from Marietta. They had a great, great team. Our guys really, though, you know, there's a lot of years and a lot of teams. You get to an Elite Eight, it ends within a week. It's like, hey, what a great season. Let's celebrate it. There was no celebration, after that, which was incredible to me, right? I mean, how can you be the coach of a program that goes to the Elite Eight and has a chance to go to the Final Four and you don't even celebrate it? You know, we had our banquet and we tried to do it as much as we could, but the guys were really, really moved. They were just upset. You know, they really felt like they let one go and that they had an opportunity to win the whole thing. And that's really where the journey began, because there was absolutely no complacency. There was no, you know, satisfaction. It was really okay. Like we got to get back there to that same moment again, so that we can make it right next time. And that really was the mindset of every one of our returners. And then we brought in some new guys and they started to understand it as the season went on.
What did those conversations look like with your returning players after that season, after that loss, when you sit down with them individually and maybe collectively as a team? What did you guys talk about? What were the plans, so to speak, both from an individual and team standpoint that you guys talked about to make sure that if you got back to that same place that you wouldn't have the same result?
Yeah, you know, so right, you have your exit meetings with the guys, you know, you have that final team meeting. And like I said, you could just feel just a level of discontent that, hey, no, we want more. We think we could have done more and we're ready to do more. And we're going to do whatever it takes to get back to that moment. And, you know, that was just really unique for me. I had never had exit meetings after an amazing season like we had had. And to a man, they were not satisfied. There wasn't one player that said, oh, you know what, though? We had a great season and we should celebrate it. And, you know, we'll see what happens next year. That wasn't the deal with these guys. And So for the coaching staff, it's like, okay, well, we better step up our game to be ready, because, you know, these guys sound like they want to do this thing. And, you know, ironically, the message was with the team and in the meetings, if there was something that they regretted, was, you know, we just can't let it come down to the last second. We can't leave it to chance. We saw Randolph-Macon run through that tournament without a game closer than 16. And the mindset was, well, that's what we need to do. We're not going to let this thing go down to the last second, which is incredibly ironic if you watched our season at all.
Where do you think that mindset came from? I mean, is that the collective that you guys have built as a program? Do you attribute that to one or two guys who are the leaders that sort of pass that feeling along to everybody else? Where did that come from? Because again, as you said, I'm not sure that that's the reaction that every individual player, that every team would always have in that situation. So where do you think that came from?
Yeah, I think I'm glad that you asked that, because I wanted to go back to, at least for us, you know, that final shot going in the basket is the product of 55 years of basketball tradition at Christopher Newport, right? There have been 27 NCAA tournament appearances. That's every other year for 55 years. It's incredible. There's been Final Fours, Elite Eight, Sweet 16s. And, you know, for me, it was my 13th year. And just thinking about those guys I had early on that kind of laid the groundwork for how we were going to do things and building our culture and the competitive spirit within the team. And, you know, and then you go to a Final Four in 2016 and, you know, it's celebrated. And then you go again in 19 and it's celebrated. And then you don't go. And it's now the expectations are built because of what those guys have done in the past, because they've been to the Final Four. Getting there is not enough anymore. Right. And not getting there certainly isn't enough. So that's been passed on because of the work that the guys before this group ever put in, and it's been passed on. And now we're recruiting players that understand that and they want that. And so this group of players, you know, sans a couple guys that didn't play a whole lot, had never been to a Final Four, because that was 2019. So, we had Tyler Trimble and Brandon Edmond, I think, who really didn't play much, that were on that team. But other than that, 15 guys had never been there, but they knew all about it. And to be that close in 22, they felt like it was our time. And so I really think it's a product of this season's a product of all the work that's been built. And what this group took from all those groups and probably added to it and did at another level was the competitive spirit. You know, led by our All-American John Hines, his brother Colin, Ty Henderson. I mean, these guys are so competitive, and it just bled through the entire team. And we had that last year in 22 as well. But this year was even a little more unbridled. You know, one of those teams that just is so competitive in practice, you got to pull them away from each other. It was that next level of competitive spirit. And I think it took us a little while to figure out how we were going to embrace that, because it wasn't always pretty. But I think once we collectively realized that was our strength, then we just ran with it. And that probably was the difference.
So you talked a little bit about coaches having to step up their game and figure that out and sort of meet the expectations of your team and get to that point where the players and the coaching staff are on the same page. So how do you go about doing that? What did you guys do in the summertime as a staff when you met together? What did you guys think about? What did you do to sort of meet those player expectations?
Well, I mean, listen, any coach will tell you that it's about the players, right? And so the number one thing we did is we brought in some guys that we thought could bolster our team. We lost Jason Agner, who's the best 3-point shooter in school history and was one of the best in the country for years. We lost Darian Peterson, who was arguably the real difference maker in the NCAA tournament last year as a power forward. Adrian Beasley was a fifth-year guy. So we lost three really important pieces from that team. So to say, oh, we want to get back there, and then you lose three guys like that, you know, first and foremost, it's we got to make sure the guys we're bringing in can can meet that standard. And so we went out and got a couple transfers, and you know, we recruited John's brother Colin extremely hard to try to get him to CNU. And you know, we felt like we needed to do that. We had a lot of really great returning players, but we felt we needed to bolster our roster to keep up, and all those guys made a huge impact. So that's first and foremost, is assembling your team. You know, we also had a change in staff. Logan Miller, who had played for me on two Final Fours, was my go-to assistant coach. He left, took a high school job at his high school where he won a state championship at Highland School this year. Awesome, awesome guy. So happy and proud for him. And, you know, we were able to go out and bring back Jaron Dyson, who had been here before, had 5 years of Division I experience. And we were able to get him back as basically an associate head coach. And that was huge for us. And then another guy, Jeremy Brown, who had been with us before, we were able to get him back as well. So, and then Roland Ross, who's been a long, long time trusted veteran assistant for us. So like our staff was bolstered in the summer. Our roster was bolstered in the summer. And more than anything, that's what we did. You know, it wasn't any fancy talk about, you know, how to work on your game or any of that stuff. I think that's got to come from the players, in my opinion, in the summertime. And it did. And so they all got better because they wanted to get better.
So what did that look like from a player standpoint? What are those guys doing? Obviously, I know I've talked about this with lots of Division III head coaches. When you talk about the importance of that leadership piece from your players because of the limited amount of contact that you're allowed to have. Although now you're going to get your 8 days. So
yeah,
be a little bit different this coming off season. But clearly if guys are going to get better and guys are going to buy in and guys are going to do the things that it sounds like your guys wanted to do, they have to do that on their own with guidance from you guys in terms of, hey, this is where we need to go. These are things that we need to work on. So from a player standpoint, what did the summer look like for them? What were guys doing? And just how did you guys approach that in terms of getting them to work on the right things and just how you sort of coalesced as a group over the summer?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, Mike. I don't have a great answer. I'll be honest. I don't do anything with them. I mean, I don't even talk to them. I don't say that, you know, and I do talk to them, right? And they come and they work camp. I don't talk to them about basketball a whole lot in the summertime. I really believe that the grind of the season and the work that they're going to put in when we start practice or in the weight room as soon as they get back to campus and the competitive nature of the guys that we bring in, it's going to take care of itself. I mean, you have the conversation at the end of the spring. Hey, what do you want? I want my role to increase, coach. I want to do this. Okay. Well, in my opinion, then you're going to have to get better at this. I'll see you in the fall. It's got to come from them. And so I don't really get involved. Some guys have trainers. Some guys stayed on campus and worked out. Some guys went home and worked summer internships and probably didn't play a whole lot. Other guys played in summer leagues. I don't even know. I really don't talk to them a lot about basketball in the summertime. I think that's their time to recharge the batteries, to get away, to be with family, to go to the beach, lift weights, whatever they want to do. I just have confidence in our staff, our players, that when we get back together in the fall, we'll get it right. We'll get them where they need to be.
You're giving them an exit plan though during your interviews at the end of the season, when you're talking with guys about, hey, this is kind of where you are now. And this is, if you want to get where you want to go, here's some ideas or thoughts about what you can do to get better. Am I accurate in that?
No, I mean, again,
yes, like, and no.
Mike, what am I going to do? Hand them a sheet of 20 ball handling drills?
Yeah, no, I got you. I got you.
I mean, seriously.
No, I understand.
I'm not trying to be, I kind of sound like a jerk. I'm not trying to be a jerk. I'm being real with you. Like when I was younger, when I was, you know, I felt like I had to in some way control what they did, right? Hey, call me every Friday. Tell me what you did this week. Or, hey, here's some workout sheets. You know, like, I think you should do this stuff. Like they're going to do it if they want to do it.
Right.
You know, and then it doesn't do me any good to get frustrated because a guy tells me something that he thinks he's supposed to be telling me he's doing. And then he shows up in the fall. I know he didn't do it. So like, how does that help the relationship? It's really simple, you know, and we have this thing called YouTube. It's like, if you want to be better at anything, get on YouTube. I mean, I can't teach you better how to make decisions on the court than Chris Paul. Go watch Chris Paul videos. What do you want to tell you? You want to be a great rebounder? Go YouTube, Dennis Rodman. Like, go watch, figure it out. You know, I think the ownership for the players, to me, is more important than anything that me or my staff could tell these guys.
And that's where you get the program to the point where you're able to do that, right? Where you have guys that you've recruited, you brought in the right types of players. Those players then had influence on the guys that come in that you bring in. So you know the type of guys and the mentality that you have in the room so that you know when you step away in the spring and give them that freedom that when they come back, that those guys are going to be prepared and they're going to be ready to go and they're going to be all the things that you just described and talked about. When you come back from that summer and you're sitting down with your staff, what are you guys talking about in terms of the prep for the season? What are some things that you guys thought were keys to having the kind of success that you wanted to have? What were you guys locking in on and saying, hey, these are the things we really want to zero in on, whether it was we want to maximize our strengths or we want to try to minimize our weaknesses? Just what approach were you taking kind of heading into that first practice?
Yeah, first, I'm going to jump back because, you know, you scratch the surface with the players and okay. We talked about it. And I do think it comes down, right? So I'm recruiting and I'm bringing in guys that love to play, that love seeing you, that are committed to the process, and that I know because we've done our homework that they understand how to take ownership over what they want. Like this is recruiting for me, not how good a guy is when he's 15. You know, it's how good he's going to be once after he gets here. And once he's exposed and around really high level players every day, that I believe he's going to get there because that's the type of person that he is, because he wants it. And when you have a room full of those kind of guys, then you don't have to, there's no motivation, right? I don't have to motivate them.
Right.
Not that, yes, we have our ways of motivating, but I mean, if you got to pull people in every day and try to get them to work hard, you're done. You've already lost. I don't care how talented they are. So that's why I can take the approach that I do, because I think I'm bringing in the guys that really want it, if that makes sense.
All right. So how do you identify those guys in the recruiting process? I mean, clearly, any coach who's sitting on a bench somewhere wants the type of guys that you just described. And some guys can't get them because their program's not there. Some guys have difficulty identifying those players accurately. What's the process that you go through to make sure that the guys have that love for the game, they have that self-motivation, they have all the attributes that you're looking for? How do you go about doing that? And is it easier to do that today than when you first started as a head coach?
I don't know if it's easier just because the stakes are higher, right? And what we're trying to achieve is greater. So,
right.
You know, it's all relative. But, I mean, first, I hate AAU, and not that I hate people that play or run AAU, or it's great for people and all that. But like, I don't think it's a great evaluative tool for me, because there's no skin in the game for those kids. They don't practice. They just play. It's fine. You can see some things in terms of athleticism, you know, and skill a little bit. But it doesn't really show me what I'm looking for. Now, I'll go to an AU practice and that will give me a much better idea of the type of player that I'm looking for. in an AU practice. I'll go to a high school practice, which often will tell me more than I'll see in the game. You know, we'll talk in depth with the coaches and try to get a sense of the type of person a player is. And I think where I've evolved as a coach is that, you know, some things that turn coaches off don't necessarily turn me off. You're looking at a player, and this is something that I always try to teach my assistant coaches when they come in. You're not looking at where he is now. You're looking at where he can be in 2 years if he loves it. So if you can determine that he loves it, then you can see the starting point. And then what are the natural gifts, right? Is it size? Is it athleticism? Is it decision-making? Is it shooting form? You watch a game, a guy goes 0 for 10. Okay. Some coaches will walk away and never recruit that guy. But if his form is perfect, I might dig a little bit deeper, right? And then there's the competitive spirit part. A lot of guys with a competitive spirit do a lot of things they probably shouldn't do when they're 16 years old. They make faces. They have bad body language. They get upset at the referee in an AU game. Huge turnoffs for a lot of coaches, and used to be for me. And I don't want too many guys that I got to start with like that. But if I got the right guy and he loves it and he's a little ultra competitive and I got to teach him how to rein it in, that's a skill like anything else. So I think all of those things kind of help me evaluate, you know, where I think a guy can be in 2 years. I think that's the critical piece. I mean, we're not like the guy who's a finished product now that we want is a Division I player.
Right.
So why am I going to go try to recruit Division I players that are going to get Division I offers? I want the guy that I think can be a Division I player in 2 years. You know, for whatever reason, what can we see that make us believe that he can be that in 2 years? Size, speed, athleticism, you know, so I don't know. It's definitely much, much more of an art in basketball than it is a science. A lot of conversations with people and coaches, assistant coaches. But as Fran Delphi told me, as a recruiter for him, you know, don't discount somebody's love for your institution. If somebody really wants to play for you and play there, that means something. So if you got two guys and one of them really wants to be there and one of them's on the fence, the guy that wants to be there is going to end up better. And so I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle too.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because I think so often, especially today, we hear it the other direction. In other words, the player talks about, I want to find the right fit. I want to find the right place for me. And a lot of times I think we discount the fact that, hey, on the other end of it, if the coach, like you said, has a choice between two players who are similar and one kid really wants to come and the other kid has five choices out there that they're kind of waffling between. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense that if a guy wants to be there, that he's probably going to put just that little bit of extra effort in there that's going to take him to a level that maybe the other kid will never get to. And I think it's interesting to sort of reverse that. Hey, find the right fit, right? You got to find the right fit as a player. But yeah, also from a coaching standpoint, if you can find players that fit your program and want to be there, man, I mean, that makes all the difference, right? I mean, you can look at any level of basketball, take it all the way up to the NBA. Guys who want to be in places usually goes pretty well. Guys who don't want to be in places,
yeah,
they make that pretty clear, and it usually doesn't work out too well for the place and the team where they are currently. So there's been lots and lots of examples of that we can go through and throw yeah. out there for sure. Yeah. So, all right. So you've got the right guys in place. You've got the type of players that you want in the room. So now as you're sitting down and you get to practice and you start going through things and you've had in your mind of what you think it's going to be, give me an idea of what the first couple of days of practice are with your guys. What's the mentality in terms of, are you seeing the same level of fierce competitiveness that they were talking about back at the end of the season? Because sometimes you know, that passion could fade and that hurt from that loss can fade. Just how were you feeling about the team and where you guys were in that first week as you came back together?
Yeah. So with our coaches, and we do this maybe every year, every other year, we'll do like a little SWOT analysis, and try to get a sense of where we are, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, within our team and within the landscape of Division III basketball that season. And, you know, there were a lot of question marks because we're coming in again without Jason Agner, who, I mean, he shot over 40% from three and he made like three a game. I mean, so our entire offense was benefited by always having a guy that could stretch the floor, which made everybody better. It made John Hines better. It made Trey Barber better. It made everybody better. And so we did not have him anymore, right? We also lost Darian Peterson, who is one of our top two rebounders and just killed it on the interior. It was a huge mismatch for people. And so we were concerned about our perimeter shooting. We were concerned about our rebounding a little bit. We were concerned a little bit with leadership because Jason not only was a great shooter, but, you know, he really was the vocal leader of the team over those last two seasons. And so there was a void there as well. You know, we had a number of capable seniors, but none of them had really stepped up into leadership roles yet. So these were the things that we were kind of looking at and have feeling that you know, we weren't going to be making 10 threes a game. So what could we do? So we thought about pressing a little bit more. We thought about really pushing the tempo a little bit more. You know, we thought about playing a little more of a five out style to open the basket. And maybe our big guys like Trey Barber and Jake Lotta were going to be guys that were going to shoot some more threes. Ian Anderson, they're capable. So these are some of the things that we were looking at. We knew we had a heck of a schedule, to start the year. I mean, really a gauntlet over the first few weeks. So we went out and scheduled two really, really hard games in Maryland Eastern Shore scrimmage and then Old Dominion exhibition game because we really wanted to get punched in the face a little bit, and really expose what our weaknesses might be. And, you know, ironically, we shot the ball fairly well against Maryland Eastern Shore, but, you know, I thought those were really good exhibitions for us to play to help us kind of get ready and start to see, you know, what we were going to be able to do. And then what some of these new guys were going to be able to do. We knew we had to keep it super simple, because we had some new pieces that we thought were going to play. We thought we could be an elite defensive team with all of these guys back. And that took a little longer than I anticipated, but we got there. So, you know, I mean, that's the first part of the year. You're always kind of toying around and trying to see where the new guys fit in. You have some ideas you think might work. You know, and then we settled into a good rhythm, I thought. I think the one piece that was the hardest was the leadership with this team. We had a lot of capable guys in different areas, but we didn't have one alpha dog. We didn't have one guy where it was just his team. So we had to kind of spread it around and we really didn't find our way in that until really into January.
So what does that look like when you find sort of a leadership by committee as opposed to that one alpha dog? What are those conversations like for you guys in the coach's office as you're kind of trying to search for that leader or that group of leaders? And then how's the approach different when you have sort of the one guy that everybody looks to versus the leadership by committee?
I've always been a leadership by committee guy. I've never had captains. Well, never. I haven't had captains for 10 years. I haven't had a team captain. Cause I believe in spreading it around, and giving guys opportunities to lead in different ways. I think it's really important. But naturally, like your seniors, you know, kind of step up and take on more of those roles naturally. You know, the other thing that was funky with the COVID year, we had guys that weren't sure whether they were going to come back. So we didn't know whether to call them seniors or not. It was just really odd. Finally, honestly, we got to a point. It was like January. I was like, dude, are you coming back next year or are you not coming back? I just need to know. I don't care what you do, but I need to know what you're doing, because this whole waffling thing, like, what makes seniors great is they know it's their last year. What makes a senior is that they know this is it. And they always rise to a level of leadership that's unbelievable, right? Because this is it for them. Whether they're playing or not playing, this is it. They're going to do whatever it takes to help the team win, whether it's practice or games. Then when you got these guys that are like fake seniors, I'll tell you, it was really hard.
I'm sure.
You know, our first meeting, we had 8 guys in the senior thing, but only 4 or 5 of them were like, really, it was their last year of eligibility. So finally I cut it down. I was like, all right, you guys, you're not in the room anymore. Like, I can only have the guys that are really, really know this is the end, because they're the ones that we need their voices heard. It took a while to get to all that, you know. It was just unique. And a lot of guys that came back had a lot of expectations. Like, they all wanted to win, but they all wanted to do it with themselves being in a pivotal role, right?
Absolutely.
They didn't go, hey, I really want to win and I'm going to be a fan. No, they worked all summer to then have a bigger role or a more pivotal role or be a starter or whatever. And so, yeah, I mean, honestly, it took us a while to figure out this particular group. The competitiveness was there. The brotherhood was there. They loved each other. They loved to play. None of that was ever in question. But the leadership, the perimeter shooting, understanding their roles, settling in, man, it was a battle. And we had our moments. If you watched our team within games, just within a game, we could be the best team in the country and incredibly mediocre in the same 40-minute game. And like, if you went to get popcorn, you know, you might go to get popcorn and be like, this is the worst team I've ever seen in my life. Come back after eating your popcorn and go, this team's going to win a whole thing, or vice versa. I mean, that's just the kind of team that we were, because of the wildly inconsistent just leadership and roles and expectations and, competitiveness and how that overtook us sometimes. It was wild, man. Yeah. And we saw it, right? As coaches, we saw it. We talked about it. We talked to the team about it. You know, we threatened them. This is what's going to happen. We're telling you what's going to happen. I don't want to have it happen, but this is what's going to happen. And, you know, they're kids. Coach, whatever, man. We're 9-0. We're 1 in the country. So, and then Hammond and Sydney came in on our home floor and really put a beat down on us. And I think it finally caught our attention.
And then you lost the second one right after that.
Yeah. And another great lesson, because, you know, they think, oh, okay, you know, we'll get it right. One day of practice, great first half. We go to Virginia Wesleyan. Guys are pissed. We're up 20 at the half. I mean, we're playing. It was the best half of basketball we played all year, first half at Virginia Wesleyan. Rival game. And then in typical fashion, they thought, oh, okay, we're good now. And Virginia Wesleyan turns it around, takes the momentum, and beats us down with a buzzer beater at the end. So that one really hurt, which was good. We needed it. We needed it. You know, those playing those types of teams and our schedule, I mean, that's how you really find out about yourself. And I think that really, that week, you know, really did it for us.
How'd you handle over the course of the year? You talked a little bit about guys obviously coming in and wanting their role to be an important role with the team and putting the time in and working. And obviously, not everybody gets the role that they want, and probably guys that from the outside look like, man, this guy's got a really good role, probably want a little bit more of a role. So How do you, as the head coach, handle somebody who you know wants to play more, you know wants a bigger role, you know is working as hard as they possibly can, and yet, for whatever reason, just because the guy ahead of them is better than they are, that they're not getting exactly what they want? How do you keep that guy bought in and making sure that that doesn't become a player-to-player issue where you have guys kind of pitted against each other instead of pulling together on the same, on the, you know, pulling in the same direction?
You know, that I'm very fortunate in that I never worried about the second part of your question. I never worried about them being divided because of that. You know, guys that might be fighting for playing time were hanging out in the locker room. They were competing fiercely in practice and then walking off the court together. They would go lift together. The guys that are fighting for the same position, like, that was something that was natural. Hopefully it's something that our culture has kind of encouraged. But I never worried about it breaking our brotherhood, which is one of our three core values that just these guys have, you know, started and embraced. You know, we talk about it, you know, like, you can want to beat your brother's butt. At the end of the day, it's your brother, so you love him and that's it, you know. And if you really have a brother, you know what I'm talking about. And so that part of it was probably one of our strengths, is that it never impacted the players. But what it did impact was the relationship with the coaches. I mean, I had to then be the bad guy, right? Because I'm the one making those decisions. And for a while, we played a lot of guys because I mean, we were super talented 1 through 17. I mean, we had guys, you could come to a practice and we had people come to practice and, hey, who's that kid? He's dynamite. And I'm like, well, he doesn't even play, you know? And so, you know, this happened all the time that a high school coach or a friend or somebody would come in and, you know, just one of the other guys that didn't play a lot would have a day. And they're like, oh man, what's that? He must be all league player. No, actually, he doesn't even play. And that's a great thing to have because our practices were so competitive, but it's really hard telling a guy, hey, you're just behind this other guy, but like, it's really, 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 really close, you know? So you just got to stay ready. And that was the other part, you know, it was part of, I think, my fault. Although I don't know that I would have done it differently because I think it probably helped us. But like the first 10, 12, 15 games of the season, we were rotating guys in and out like a Chinese fire drill. I mean, just boom, 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 boom. Like, they're running in and out of there because I'm looking for answers, or I'm feeling like I got to give a guy an opportunity because he's earned it. And the gap is so close that we played a lot of players. We gave him a lot of opportunities. We put him in some big moments and some big spots. But that also led them to believe they were in the mix now, even though it might have just been for that game. It takes them a while to get used to that concept. Hey, you might play 12 minutes in this game and you might not even get in the next game because it has to do with size and matchups and can you defend your position and, you know, what do we need against that particular team? We're very scout heavy. So that all took us a while too. But again, I think it's all part of what made us who we were and allowed us to ultimately be ready come tournament time.
You play the defending champs, Randolph-Macon, which obviously is a game that I'm sure that you guys were looking forward to and was a game that was a measuring stick. And that's a game that you lose. And then from that point on, you don't lose again. So when you think back to that game, what do you remember about the game itself and then kind of where you guys were physically and mentally coming out of that game?
Yeah, I mean, it was a It was a great basketball game. It was a high level game. It was at Randolph-Macon. Our guys really wanted to win, but they probably wanted to win a little more because, you know, in 21-22, they lost one game all season and it was against us at our place. So, you know, this thing has become a big time rival. And we went in there and we were starting to figure some things out with our group. And we played really well. And in those types of games, it's usually going to be somebody other than the big ones that step up. And for them, they had the kid, Daniel Bangay, who was really like a third, fourth, fifth option. And he had a career night. And that was the difference in the game. And, you know, it was all that you could think about on the road, great environment, rivalry game, defensive battle. We had the lead. We were playing really well. And we made a couple big defensive breakdowns at the end. And they took advantage. And I actually think the game didn't really hurt us. I thought it was like, okay, we didn't execute at the end. We could have played better. And we were right there. And that's the number. I think they were number one at the time, maybe two. Like, okay, we're good. We're right there. We're going to be all right. And from there, I thought it really took off.
So when it takes off, what's that feel like in practice, in games, just in the energy within the team? How, when you guys start to get on this roll, what's that feel like as a coach and with your team day in, day out on the practice floor?
I just think at that point, the buy-in of defending and rebounding the way that we're accustomed to and the way we're capable of, they just took a little more ownership over it. We had been good to that point. But I think they realized, okay, wow, if we want to win this thing and we have an off night shooting, like we're going to have to really make sure we defend and rebound at a high level. And cause it can come down to the last possession, and they embraced it. And to me, that was the difference, because we were very talented and we could score a lot of points, but you're going to, in a 6-game tournament, you're going to have a night where you don't shoot the ball particularly well, or a team matches up well, like Farmingdale State did, or, you know, someone gets in foul trouble or it just doesn't go your way. You got to be able to string together stops, and you got to be able to rebound the ball. And I told them from day one, we had talked about, I forget the exact statistic, but we had been to the NCAA tournament 9 times, I think, in my tenure at CNU. 7 of the losses we were out-rebounded in, despite having an incredibly high rebounding margin number for the year. And so I said, like, you can rebound all you want in a regular season. When it comes to the playoffs, when it comes to the NCAA tournament, we have been eliminated 9 times, 7 times was because we got out rebounded. So, you know, you guys decide what it's going to be. And so that's just something that we kept harping on. And you know, I'm incredibly proud of our group, because to go against a Mount Union team and out rebound them, to me, that was the game.
All right, let's go back to the eve of the tournament and you get the draw. What's your first thought as you're looking at your draw and you're trying to sort of look at the path? Are you looking at the path all the way to the national title game, or are you just dialed in on what's our first round matchup and we better take care of business here? How do you look at that as a coach?
Well, as soon as it came out, I was like, oh, crap. Because, I mean, number one, my players had no familiarity with Farmingdale State. So they had no frame of reference to know how good they were. So it's just some team from some place they've never heard of. How good can they be? Right. That was my team's thought. I was in the league with Farmingdale. They were the best team in New York for a long time. I mean, big time players, coaches, tradition, history, all that stuff. And so I was scared to death for that game. And then as I dug in and really saw the type of team that they had and knew the matchup was not particularly favorable for us, you know, then I really got, I think I even, you know, as a coaching staff, I think I said, like, this first game is going to be, this could be the hardest game of the tournament. I mean, it could be one of those deals. If we get through this first game, we're in really good shape, but I don't know if we can get through the first game. And yes, I probably for the first time or one of the few times in my career, I did. I kind of, you know, we took a peek at the bracket and, you know, we got sent to Hamden, Sydney. So, you know, we anticipated and wanted to play Hamden, Sydney. And I also knew that that was part of the problem with Farmingdale State was our guys wanted to beat Hamden, Sydney so bad.
Right. Yep.
Like, that's all they were thinking about, you know. So they were excited about, we knew we were going on the road because of the male-female thing, men's and women's, you know, so we knew we had to go on the road. And there had been a lot of talk about, at least with the coach and the coaches in the administration, you know, we really felt, you know, we had a great team. We were number one seed. And once again, we were going to have to go on the road because the NCAA Championships Committee, for some reason, can't wrap their head around men and women playing on the same weekend in the same venue, which is completely ridiculous, by the way.
Yeah, it seems like it would be.
We could absolutely host both men and women and give a championship experience they would remember, as could many other institutions. So it's completely ridiculous. So now we're going to have to go on the road. And because of geography, likely go on the road the second weekend because it's 500 miles and all this other stuff. So I did take a peek to see how they put the bracket together for that reason. And it was like, wow, they really, for the first time ever, they really looked closely at this thing and lined it up so that if we were to win the first weekend, we would likely host the next weekend, which is something we've never done because of geography. Our other two Final Fours, we got sent on the road in the Elite Eight because of geography. So it was like, holy cow. Not only do we get to play a rematch game with Hamden and Sydney possibly, and we only have to travel two and a half hours. If we get through that weekend, we get to come home. Like, that's incredible. We've never had that opportunity. We've always been on the road. So we did look at that. And again, I was like, man, if we get through this first weekend, we got a chance to come home. And we're really good at home. So, you know, and then I didn't look much beyond that to like Final Four stuff or whatever. But just to look at those first two weekends, to know we had a chance to play Sydney in a rematch, and then to know that if we were to get through that weekend, we had a chance to come home for the first time in the second round. Like, all those things were right in front of us, but what was really right in front of us was Farmingdale State. And that was very scary.
So that's a game you win 61-60. So obviously your fears were well-founded. What about them made them such a tough matchup for you guys?
They were old, experienced. They're New York City guards, New York guys. They defend at a very high level. So, and they weren't going to be scared. You know, like, I knew they're not going to, oh, Christopher Newport, number two in the country or whatever we were, you know, NCAA tournaments, all this stuff. Like, maybe if they had come to CNU and saw the banners, maybe they would have been intimidated, maybe a little bit, but not really. I mean, these are New York City guys. Like, they don't care about us. They're well coached. They defend. They're athletic. They're talented. They're older. They're New York City guys. And I think most importantly, they were not intimidated by us whatsoever. They were thinking the same thing. Who the heck's Christopher Newport? You know, I never heard of that place. And so they had a swagger to them. Like, they went in there to win the game. And you could see it from the outset. And all the credit to them and their coaches. And try as we might, our guys were not, they just, you know, they prepared, but they weren't ready for that.
You guys get through that game. And then you get your rematch with Hamden-Sydney. What do you remember about that game? I'm assuming you guys, after you survived the scare in the first round, that you guys are locked in for that second round game.
Yeah, I mean, it was the easiest scout, you know, and that's the best part of it is you're playing a back-to-back. Well, now, the other thing is Hamden-Sydney and Emory go to an all-out war that night. And this was kind of special. So one of the only benefits of playing on the road in the first round is if you're in the neutral game, you play first. So you get to play. You get an extra warm-up. You get to play. And then you're done. So if you advance, now you get to sit there with your feet up and eat your pizza and watch the next game while these guys are killing each other, right? Till 10 o'clock at night,
right?
Or 11 or whatever it is. So we're kick back, eat the pizza. We always leave at halftime. And because I want them to get rest, we'll watch film, whatever. And the guys are like, Coach, we want to stay. Great atmosphere, great game. So we stayed till the damn ending of the game. I mean, like, the whole – we stay – like, guys, we got to get out of here. It's like 30 seconds to go, and we're racing through the back door. They opened it up for us so we could get out of there. And, you know, Emory had them beat. They had a shot in the corner to tie or win the game from three. That would have been a really unique and difficult matchup for us because they play so much zone, and we hadn't seen a lot of zone. But Sydney wins. They survive. And our guys were super excited. They were jacked. They were, you know, we knew their players. We knew their plays. They knew ours. It was just going to be a rock fight. But we came out. We played we defended. So in both of those games, I think our defensive numbers were like 30% field goal percentage defense for both games. We just guarded them like crazy. Yeah, we put on a clinic defensively and made a couple timely shots, and that was that. It was great. Great environment, great game.
Then you come home, and as you said, special to be able to do that. What was the atmosphere like for those next two games?
Yeah, it was even greater than I would have thought. I'm like, we have this atmosphere at CNU. We have this unbelievable marching band and cheerleaders and dance team and stuff, but it was spring break. So we didn't really have all those extra amenities, but the community really came out. And against Mary Harden Baylor, it was electric in there. It was a great atmosphere. And again, I think we really set the tone defensively for 30, 35 minutes of the game. And they really had a really hard time scoring against us, which gave us confidence. And then we were able to pull away a little bit. You know, their one kid went a little crazy at the end to keep them in it, but, you know, we really, really played well against Mary Harden Baylor. And then the next one, Wheaton and St. Joe's, was a terrific game, and we didn't know who we'd play. But similarly, we kind of jumped up on Wheaton. We defended them extremely well. I think we were up 20 at the half, or pretty big number at the half. We had made shots, we guarded, and their point guard went crazy in the second half, brought them all the way back, but we survived. And that's kind of who we were, right? Big leads, give it away, hang on at the end. That was kind of our MO. You want to write a book.
That's a fun coaching roller coaster to be on all the time, man. That's a blast to coach a team that does that, isn't it?
I mean, people ask why I was so calm. I was like, I've seen this movie 100 times already this year.
It's coming again, right? That's exactly one of those ones where you're watching that clock, man. That clock clamp can't move fast enough, I'm sure. Oh,
ask the Boston Celtics. Ask the Boston Celtics how they feel about that kind of basketball.
Oh, that's crazy. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. All right, tell me about the Final Four.
I mean, just it's the Final Four, right? And for the majority of my guys, their first one. We getting to Fort Wayne from Newport News is not easy. But, you know, it was cool. We flew into Chicago. We got in late. We were the latest team to get in, and then everything was delayed. I had guys were in class, so we didn't get in until like 2 to 3 o'clock in the morning on the Wednesday night. When did we play? Thursday? So on the Tuesday night. And so we were supposed to practice like 9 a.m. Thankfully, they moved the practices back so we could practice at like 1 o'clock or something. So we got in at Chicago. We got some deep dish pizza. We were going to watch Rocky III on the bus. We're all excited, and then realized we bought the Blu-ray and not the DVD. So everything's delayed in the airport, whatever. So we get into Fort Wayne like 3 o'clock in the morning. We get up, we go over there, we have our practice. And, you know, everything's great. We had done this thing from the jump, with our shoelaces. It was just kind of something quirky. I wanted to keep the pressure off. I wanted to like, just make the tournament be different. Like, it's not just another game. So we did this thing where every game we wore a different color shoelaces, the whole team. So I spent $600 on shoelaces, which is ridiculous. Don't
nice. Hey.
So the first round, I think we wore white, and then the game ends, and the next day we get together for a walkthrough, and we literally sat there for 20 minutes, unlaced shoes, and put in black or whatever the next color was. And thank God we had enough time, because I had like three guys that I don't think they knew how to tie shoes, because it took them like 45 minutes to get the shoelaces back in. So we go to the next weekend, and we had blue and orange maybe or something. So then every game we did that. So that was our ritual. So then the big thing was to get to the Final Four. You get silver in the semis, and if you get to the championship, you wear gold. So we changed over the shoes when we got on Thursday to the silver, which was cool. It was kind of a big moment for us to be able to wear the silver. And, you know, just that we also had our guys. So, you know, you're watching film to scout your opponent. For us, it was Swarthmore, who our guys do know Swarthmore, and they have a ton of respect for Swarthmore. You know, we had played Hopkins earlier, and they knew that in 2019, in the very same game in the semis, we lost to Swarthmore. We have a player, Savante Chapel, who works at CNU right now. We see him every day. He was on that team, and he, you know, he had talked to a lot of the guys about that game. And we actually, in our preparation for the game, we watched that game. We watched the 2019 Final Four game that we lost to Swarthmore. Because, I mean, they're very similar, different players, but very similar style. And so we were able to draw a lot from our past and our experience in watching that game and having our guys feel that history and what it would mean to get by them. And we did, and we played extremely well. And they made a run at the end, but that was more, again, us being us, where we missed free throws and it just did some boneheaded things in the last few minutes of the game. But for the majority of the game, we were really, really good. And that was a tremendous win and opportunity for us. And again, really cool because it was the first game. So then we got to sit there and watch Whitewater and Union play. And again, the guys at halftime didn't want to go home. They wanted to watch the whole game. Again, just tells you about the competitive nature of our team.
For sure. Well, based on the description of the season, right? It sounds like the championship game played out exactly the way you would have drawn it up in your 100%. Head after coaching your team the entire season. There was no way that they were going to take their 5-point lead with a minute and run the clock out and hit some free throws and go in the locker room and celebrate. It had to be a little bit more thrilling and exciting. So how do you get your team ready in that short amount of time to prepare for such a high level game? And then just walk me through a little bit about what happened in that game and how you guys were feeling and what you were going through, the emotions that you guys felt as that game was going on.
Now, just to back up. So did you watch the end of the Swarthmore game?
I did not.
So in the last, I'm pulling up the thing here because I don't want to get it wrong. In the last 30 seconds, we missed 5 out of 6 free throws. And we were up like 9 points. And they have a shot at the buzzer with their best 3-point shooter from about 22 feet straight on that hits the back of the rim and out. And we were up 3. That's how close we were going to overtime in that game.
So you already survived once, and well, you've already survived multiple times.
Let's we put survived it that way. So many times,
that?
Right?
And that,
and
that?
So when you say, yeah, I knew exactly what was coming, you know, and so yeah, we had gotten down. I mean, in the first half of the Mount Union game, I mean, it was scary. Like we could not score. I mean, we could not put the ball in the basket. They came out incredibly physical and aggressive. They guarded us. They were physical with us, and we looked completely out of sorts on offense. We weren't sharing the ball. Guys were used to making plays one on one. They couldn't make them, and we couldn't score. I mean, and fortunately, we defended well enough to hang around, and then we finally got a little breakthrough at the end of the half to cut the thing to 3, which is a miracle. If you watch that half of basketball, for us to be down 3 is a miracle, because we couldn't score. And then in the second half, we really played with some confidence, found our rhythm, and then really started playing away. Like we were pulling away. It's like the same thing as many of the other games, as we started to pull away. I mean, I don't know what the number was, but we were up 6, 8, 10 in the second half. And really like a possession or two away from making it a double-digit lead game. And then, of course, we didn't. and then we turned it over and missed some free throws. And next thing you know, we're down 1. And it's just like, you know, guys on the bench are freaking out a little bit. And it was like, hey, it's who we are. This is us. You know what I mean? You can want it any other way. This is how it's going to be. One way or the other, this is how it's going to be. So you play with fire. Sometimes you get burnt. Sometimes you don't. And we did. And we were fortunate enough to make enough plays there in that game to win. And great atmosphere, great team, great game. I mean, Mount Union, absolutely worthy of being in the championship game. And would have been a worthy champion. Just terrific team, coached, experienced, school, support, fans. I mean, they had it all. And, you know, in some ways I felt like we were David beating Goliath. Like it was a big win to go in there to the Midwest where they had the place rocking and come out of there with a win.
Talk about the decision. This is obviously always something that coaches debate of, do you call timeout? Do you not call timeout before that final 4.3 seconds? Just what's obviously that's something that you've thought about beforehand. That's not a decision that you're probably making in the moment. It's something that you've considered, you've talked about it, you've thought about the possibilities. Just why not the timeout in that situation?
So thankfully it worked out, Mike, right? If we had turned the ball over there and lost the game, it would have been because I held to my guns and did what I said we're going to do for the last 10 years.
Absolutely.
But man, it could have cost us. But that's what we do. And our guys know it. We talk about it. And I stubbornly held to it because we lost at Salisbury in 2015 in the championship game. We were at their place. We were up 6 with a minute to go. We have a really bad final offensive possession, up 1.
there's like 3-4 seconds to go. They don't call a timeout. They push the ball down the floor. We foul them 0.7 seconds, makes both. We lose a championship game. Didn't make the NCAA tournament. I would argue that play is the reason why we haven't missed one since, and probably the springboard towards the national championship this year, because at that time I decided I'm never calling timeout at the end. It is so hard to get back in transition at the end of a emotional game, and you have players that are in and out of the game to substitution. Maybe they were in just for offense. You have all sorts of chaos going on. Like, you're going to be able to get the ball to the basket. Very, very hard to stop somebody from getting the ball to the basket in that situation. And what are you going to draw up that's going to be any better than that? So our philosophy has been ever since, get it and go. And now usually what made this one a little funky is usually that conversation's being had with my point guard, Ty Henderson. And we do it every day. I mean, we do end of game stuff nearly every day. And it's like, man, go. You know I'm not calling timeout. Go, go, go. And we time them, and they know it. And my point guard can get from end to end in 4 seconds and score. And he actually, and what people don't give enough credit to is that's what Ty did the play before. The play of the game was the play before.
Right. Yep.
Where we didn't, again, call a timeout. And we had just lost the lead for the first time in like 15 minutes. And everyone in the place then is thinking, oh my God, call timeout. And Ty takes the ball, beats his man at half court, and gets an and one at the other end to give us the lead. Makes the free throw, we're up 2. That's the only reason we're in that situation. Is because that kid did exactly what we tell him, go to the rack. And so he finishes. We're up 2. They come down. They tie it. Ty's out of the game. So I had Ty out of the game because defensively we wanted bigger defenders on Gurley and some of their shooters. So I had Ty, my point guard, was out of the game. John Hines normally takes the ball out of bounds. But because Ty was out of the game, John thought he needed to get the ball. So Matt Brody took the ball out of bounds. So now we're all out of sorts, right?
Right, right.
Complete chaos. And I'm just watching, and I'm kind of looking, but they were in complete chaos too. So they ran a guy, maybe two, to John Hines because, he's the All-American. So we got to stop John Hines from getting the ball. So that smart choice. But now the floor is completely wide open. So Matt Brody takes the ball, and I'm watching, and he throws it up to Trey, who – we see Trey every day. I mean, Trey can shoot. He can handle. He's a very skilled big guy. And, if he fumbled it or put the ball over his head or something, I would have called a timeout. But he took the ball and just started driving to the basket. And everybody's backing up. And it's a tie game. I'm like, well, I guess we'll see how this goes. I mean, the worst that can happen is he dribbles it off his foot out of bounds or something, right? I mean, nobody was even close enough to take it from him because they were all backing up. They didn't want to foul him.
Right, exactly. That not wanting to foul, I'm sure, was a huge piece of the success of that, right? Especially after they gave up the 3-point play.
Yeah, before. Right. Nobody you're backing up. You don't want to foul. Yeah. It's a tie game. And now here comes a 6'8 guy driving it. Like, and if you watch the film, like, he's going with a purpose. There's no hesitation there.
Right. Yeah. He's just, he's head down, going right to the rim.
And I'm not going to draw anything up better than that. The guy who's the MVP of the tournament, who's got 21 points or whatever it was, and he's driving it to the basket. Okay. This is good. There's not a play I could run that could get him the ball in that position. And so, I mean, to the kid's credit, he just had that aggressive mindset. And I'd like to think it's because we do it every day. Again, I'm not going to lie to you and tell you we throw it to him every day, but they know, go to the rack. And he went, and it worked out.
What did it mean for the kids?
Yeah, just again, having lost the way they did the year before and being in so many close games and the ups and downs of the season, You could see the joy on their faces. I've never seen Trey Barber smile so much. Just, you know, it was, yeah. You know, you used to watch the celebration afterwards, and you know, they were just through the moon. It was an awesome experience, and you know, the committee and the folks that ran the event, you know, they just made it really special for the guys.
What about for you on a personal level? Obviously, you're happy for your guys, and that's probably the overwhelming emotion. But just for you and the culmination of 13 years of putting in the work and going back to the beginning of our conversation of just how you got there over the course of building the program up to get to this moment, how much satisfaction, just what were your emotions like in the aftermath of that game?
Yeah, I mean, for me, and somebody actually sent a screenshot of me, I think I had my head in my hands. I mean, just, I'm not a big jump around for joy guy anyway, but it was just an incredible sense of relief for a moment. But then the referees came over and said, we got to review the play. So that it went from, did that really happen? Like,
did it count?
To then, like, Sarah Quatrochi's over there with the trophy behind the bench, but the referees are over there, and I'm asking her, like, did it go in? Are we good? Like, what's going on? My God, I'm trying to get my team back to the bench because I'm thinking, if we got to go to overtime, I mean, these are human beings. I thought it went in, but, like, if we have to go to overtime, I got to get these guys. They got to get back here, you know? Like, we got to get ready. And then finally, when the official went out, I knew what the call was going to be because his body language, you know, you could see that he was going to call it good. And then it was just complete relief. Like, I, you know, that's more of what it was than anything else. And in the time that's passed, you know, we're a little ways out here now. It's just been really, really cool to see and feel and hear from the guys that I've coached before me, the guys that were here before, and what it meant to them, to the program, because that team didn't just show up. I mean, it was the product of 55 years of basketball history, and to have that, because I mean, there's a lot of programs that are never ever going to win one, you know, and so to be among that very, very small group of basketball programs and very, very small group of basketball coaches that can say they've won a national championship is, it's, as somebody said to me the other day, they can't take it away from you. You know, it's yep. just something that you'll always have, your team, your program, CNU. It's just something that you have forever. And yeah, I think that's a pretty enormous thought, but it's real.
No, it's really well said. I think the thing that struck me there as you're talking is the fact that you brought along a lot more people than just the guys in your locker room and your coaching staff. You brought along the university, you brought along the community, you brought along all the players who played there throughout that past 55 year history. That's powerful to be able to say that, hey, not only was it just us, but we did it for this other group as well. Guys who are connected to our program and people in the community and everything else. I think sometimes that part of it maybe gets lost a little bit, but the fact that you think about just how impactful that could be for not only your guys in the locker room, but just everybody who's associated with the program, I think that's really powerful. Let's wrap up by looking ahead and thinking about the challenges that you have moving forward. So as you look towards next season, what do you see as being the biggest challenge on the horizon?
Our schedule. Who do you think wants to play us? I mean, the only people that want to play us are the people think they can beat us. You know,
So we have an incredibly challenging schedule next year. You know, the way our conference is, it's really, really wonky. I mean, I got to get 20 non-conference games. So like, I don't have a built-in 16 or 18 game schedule. I have five. So I've had to go out and get all these games from teams that are really, really good. So I think our schedule is going to be daunting. We do have a lot of returners, and that's really exciting. How they're going to respond after this year, I have no idea, but I'm not going to do anything different. Kind of like, hey, you know what it took. You know how close it was. If you want to do it again, you know what you need to do, you know, and we're going to bring in a pretty healthy freshman class, which I'm excited about, and, you know, kind of see where it goes when we get back together. See, we'll find out what our strengths and weaknesses are as a group next year when we get back together. But I would like to think that the group's going to have some confidence about them. I'm going to like to think that they loved and enjoyed the experience so much that they want to do it again. I'm going to like to think that they learned a whole lot about what it takes, and they're going to be able to impart that on the new guys. So I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of positives, and we're going to have to grow up quick though next year. I'll tell you that, because we will have a target on our back, and we will have some really, really good teams gunning for us.
You're going to learn together what it's like to defend a national championship.
Exactly. Hey, and if you told me that would be our biggest problem, I'll sign up for it every year.
There you go. Yep, every year. Let's take that and see what we can do. Let's take it and run. All right, before we get out, John, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, find out more about your program, social media, email, website, whatever you want to share, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, well, on a personal level, I'm not much of a social media guy, as you probably know. I'm bad. So I'm not even sure I can tell you that. What are these? How do I even do that, Mike?
Your handle, man. Here, I'm gonna find you right now.
Can you do that? I don't even know. Hashtag something.
I'm gonna find you
basketball. You can find CNU basketball just about anywhere.
Yep.
Go ahead.
The program's Twitter is at CNU basketball, which I think that's what I always tag when I put the replay of your old episodes out. So
there you go.
That's where you want to go. Start it at CNU basketball on Twitter, and then that will get you anywhere else you need to know to find more about John and the program at Christopher Newport. And again,
Mike, hold on. You're not going to ask about the earrings?
All right. Tell me about the earrings.
You don't know about the earrings.
I don't know about the earrings. I miss the earrings.
So when we're done, you can go on that at CNU basketball. I think it's on the Twitter. Not even be on that Twitter. You might have to find it somewhere else. But
all right.
Mike Cherry was on one of my first teams here. Was one of the all-time great players. Conley Taylor, Paul Meredith. We had some guys. And we went to the NCAA tournament in my second year. I think it was 2011-12. And they knew how much I hate jewelry, like on me or any of that. Like tattoos, none of that stuff is really for me. And they said, Coach, well, if we win a national championship, you'll get a tattoo. I said, no way. I'm not getting a tattoo. They said, how about earrings? I said, all right, I'll do earrings. So it got passed on year after year after year. And as we've gotten closer, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. So about 2 weeks ago, after our team banquet, we went over to the tattoo parlor and I got earrings in. So
nice.
It's on video. We filmed the whole thing. It's ridiculous.
Right. I'm looking through the Twitter. I don't see it on the CNU basketball Twitter.
And that's right. They're probably smart enough. My managers are probably smart enough to know I would not approve of that.
They're like, we're not risking the ire of Coach Krikorian by putting that on Twitter.
And they're gone. I already took them out. They're done. I never promised how long I'd keep them in. So I kept them in for about 4 days.
Nice.
But so you got to find – it might be somewhere in – you know, like you got to go deep and find it, but it's out there. And
we're gonna find
it. We're going to find it. Use it as the headliner picture, Mike.
The headline
is going to be that's going to be the earring photo is going to be the photo that's going to lead the episode. So we're going to
do that. We will never talk again, Mike. I will never on or off the air ever again will we talk.
Well, I'll tell you one thing: we are going to file. We are going to put the last minute of the national championship game in the show notes for sure. We will definitely put a link to that so that people can see it and listen. I'll say what I said at the very beginning. Congratulations. It is an unbelievable accomplishment. And after talking to you back when we, you know, first met down at the Billis camp and then doing the episode, which I don't know what that 4 years ago probably is when we talked the last time. And I remember coming out of that conversation, just thinking about the fact that a lot of the things, what I remember about that conversation was just how I felt like you were very forward thinking and that you were always looking for ways to get an edge for your team, you know, on and off the floor. And I'm happy for you that all those things have paid off and that, you know, you reached the pinnacle. And anybody who listens to the conversation tonight can tell that that's, you know, you got to the top of the mountain. And I think there's no question that you want to stay there. And so again, congratulations to you. Congratulations to your team. Congratulations to, you know, the entire Christopher Newport community for getting that thing done. And again, we're so thankful for you taking the time out of your schedule to join us and go through this championship season.
My pleasure, Mike. It was great to be on. Thanks. I love what you're doing, man. Keep it up. And you're putting so much good content out there for people to get better. I enjoy listening to it when I can. I can't say I listen to all of them.
Understood. Well, we're cranking out a lot of episodes, man. So if you're listening to all of them, you probably aren't doing what you're supposed to be doing. So if you catch one once in a while, we'll take that. But again, thank you. We really appreciate your time. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.